Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I was thinking about this the other day. I bought my first copy of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations on Amazon in the fall of 2006. I pulled up the receipt not that long ago, but I remember the other two books I bought. I bought a book called Sex on the Brain, which is about the relationship between sex and gender, and a book called The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris, which remains one of my absolute favorite books. But I think about how lucky I was, not just that I lived in a country where I could buy a book on demand over the internet or that I could afford to do so, but I had been recommended Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, and so I typed it in on Amazon. And for whatever reason, the one I bought, the Gregory Hayes translation for the Modern Library, which we sell in the Painted Porch, which you can check out in the show notes here. But that for whatever reason, Amazon's algorithm surfaced the right translation for me at the time. They didn't value some, you know, chintzy or cheap ripoff translation or, you know, whatever. That the algorithm in that moment gave me exactly what I needed. That book came 2 days later, changed my life completely. We wouldn't be talking here if that connection hadn't been made. And yes, is there something special about bookstores? Of course, I own a bookstore. I think that there is. There's something about browsing a bookstore. There's something about editorial curation. At the same time, this worked too, right? It gave me exactly what I needed when I needed it. And perhaps someone who's listening to me now, maybe you heard about this podcast because it was recommended by Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or you randomly were suggested one of our YouTube videos, or you came across an article from a Google search, or maybe my book was surfaced to you on Amazon. The point is, there's so much randomness and luck out there. I do feel like it was fated for me to be introduced to the Stoics. I feel grateful and blessed. And at the same time, I understand that these algorithms, as complicated as they are, and I talk about this in today's episode, as destructive as they can be, they are also feats of human brilliance and innovation. And they've done lots and lots of good. Have they contributed to political polarization? Yes. Have they, you know, ended in the elimination of jobs that, you know, were previously done by experts or people of taste? Yes, that's problematic, sure. But there's also been a whole bunch of things that were not possible without them. In fact, my book, The Obstacle is the Way, you know, part of the reason it succeeded is that when it came out on Amazon, about a couple months into it, my publisher did a discount promotion, and it discounted the book as an ebook from like $9.99 or $11.99 to like $3.99. Sales spiked up, and then Amazon's algorithm said, "Oh wow, when this book is cheaper, it sells more copies." And then in response to that, Amazon kept the price artificially low for something like 11 months. And if you look at the sales track record of The Obstacle is the Way, that was instrumental in the introduction of that book to a wide audience. So again, we might not be talking, I might not have the career I have as an author. Stoicism might not have reached the millions of people that it's reached here in the 21st century if it were not for the power of that algorithm. So I just think that's something that's strange and weird and fascinating. And that leads me to today's guest, the author Brad Stone, the author of The Everything Store, his first book about Amazon. And then he's now the author of this new book, Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. When he wrote The Everything Store, Amazon was a bookstore and many other things, but really became the behemoth that it became in the years after that book. And so he got a chance to tackle Amazon Web Services, all the things that Jeff Bezos has done since, including, its incredible performance and, sort of aggressive expansion during the pandemic. Brad is a senior executive editor at Bloomberg News. As I said, his first book, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos in the Age of Amazon, is a New York Times bestseller, translated in more than 35 languages. His book, The Upstarts, Uber, Airbnb, and the Battle for the New Silicon Valley, is also wonderful. He's covered Silicon Valley for more than 25 years, and he lives in the Bay Area. It's a fascinating book. It's a book I believe we carry here at the Painted Porch, among others. I thought this was a great interview. I'm fascinated by it, both from the industry side, as a person who publishes books, as a person who sells books, as a person who has e-commerce, as a person who buys stuff on the internet and needed things during the pandemic that I couldn't get in stores. This is just a conversation I was really excited to have. If you haven't listened to my conversation with Tobias Luetke, the founder of Shopify, I think these two episodes go well together. But in the meantime, here is my interview with Brad Stone, author of Amazon Unbound and The Everything Store. Check out his books, check out this interview, and I'll talk to you soon. I think this is in your first book, but it's one of my favorite stories. So I thought we could start there because I think it goes to the essence of the brand and person you've been biographizing or at least it's an eternal question with them is you tell that story about Jeff Bezos and his grandfather and grandmother. She's smoking and he sort of does the math on what the cost of smoking is. And maybe you could tell the rest of the story and then we could sort of dissect it a little bit.
That's right. Yeah, I just pulled my copy of The Everything Store, my first book about Amazon and Jeff Bezos, which chronicles the early years of the company and the early years of his life. And Bezos's formative years were spent, with his family moving from city to city because his stepfather was a petroleum engineer. But then over the summers with his grandparents who had a ranch in southern Texas. And one of the things that they did was they would take campers out onto the road every couple of years and just drive with a bunch of other families. And he and Bezos at the time, is this sort of mathematically oriented kid. And there's a public service announcement comes over the radio, and he and it's about smoking and how many years off your life it can take. And apparently he does the math and informs his grandmother, who was a smoker and who would later die of cancer, that that she was taking a certain number of years off her life. And his grandfather, who was a NASA engineer, rocket engineer, who really inspired Bezos's love of space, stops the camper, brings him outside and gives him a lecture. And one of the lines of the lecture is it's harder to be clever. It's harder to be kind than clever, I think is the line. And, and Bezos talked about that. I believe it was in the speech he gave at the graduation of Princeton. And I remember Amazon employees finding that interesting because Bezos hadn't necessarily sprayed them with kindness over the years. So that he relayed that anecdote was interesting to them.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by it for so many reasons. First off, because the distinction between clever and kind and how it's easier to be one than the other is itself kind of a clever observation, which I like. And then it's also complicated because Bezos is totally right. His grandmother is doing a thing that is, it's a hard truth, but it's a truth nevertheless. And then, yeah, as you said, he I guess that would be my first question for you, which is, is he a kind person? Like, is that a word you would use to describe him and his rise?
Definitely not. It's not to say he's not kind, but that's not what he's optimized for in his professional life. He has been single-minded in kind of architecting systems for growth, systems for invention at Amazon, systems to get the best out of people, to be the most efficient, to push the boundaries of technology. And, you know, it's interesting, Ryan, we're talking now at the very end of Bezos's tenure as CEO. And one of the last things that he did, one of the last things Amazon did while Bezos was CEO, is they added two new leadership principles to those 14 kind of sacrosanct leadership principles. And one of the new additions was to be the Earth's best employer and to lead with empathy. And that they've just added that now 27 years into the founding of the company. And it tells you something, right? Sure. It tells you that maybe they've listened to the criticism that it has been an unkind place to work.
Yeah, and you have some quips in both the books, like sort of things he famously says to people who are, you know, like, why are you wasting my life? You know, do you think I took my stupid pills today? I think that's one of the tensions that brilliant people and busy people and ambitious people have, which is that most people aren't up to your standards or level. And how do you balance the tension between getting the difficult things that you want to get accomplished with these quaint or let's say important notions of kindness and empathy and all of that?
Yeah. And you know, I should point out that the outward jibes that I kind of chronicle in the first book, The Everything Store, where Bezos would just hammer his employees with those one-liners, that was very early Bezos. And he has evolved quite a bit since then. I don't think he would decimate anyone, at least at Amazon, in the same way. I think he realized at a certain point that his stature had grown, the company had grown. He professionalized. One of the big mysteries, even among the senior ranks at Amazon, was whether Bezos had any sort of management a management counselor. And that was a mystery I gave myself and was
like never, a coach or something.
Yeah, coach, right? And I was never able to figure that out. But he did, his leadership style did evolve. And while I don't necessarily think that it became all that much more empathetic, he wasn't known, and he could still be difficult at meetings. He didn't throw the kind of tantrums that I'm chronicling in the Everything Store in the early days of Amazon.
And it's hard to give someone credit for sort of not being as bad as they're like could get away with being. But like I found that the sort of the few instances that you did detail, you know, that would have been like an average Tuesday for Steve Jobs or you know, even many different presidents over the years. Like leaders right. are notoriously sort of short and blunt and sort of suffer no fools.
Right. Well, in the new book, in Amazon Unbound, which is very much the last 10 years of Amazon's growth and really the more, in some ways, the more exciting business story because it grows to a $1 trillion company, you know, you see a different kind of Bezos leadership. And he walks out of some meetings, in particular during the development of Alexa, where he just feels like they haven't solved the data gathering challenge to make Alexa smart. Or in these senior leadership meetings, what they call OP1 meetings, where he's just like a sharpshooter in the questions he's asking one after another that exposes the underlying unprofitability of the retail business. I think, yeah, but I do think the leadership style evolved and it became, less outwardly temperamental and more just precision questioning and then using himself the questions he asked and the time he spent in meetings to send the same messages of either disappointment or acclaim.
Yeah, I remember reading once about Churchill that as he took some high position in British government, this is before he's prime minister, the outgoing person gave him some advice and it said, like, you know, it helps to be a good butcher. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that that's one of the realities of, you know, being a Jeff Bezos or any sort of leader, which is that, you know, what you're doing is inherently, you know, saying no or mm-hmm. making decisions that have, you know, cost benefit and that, like, you know, the decision, you know, it's easy to be, you know, it's better to be kind than clever or whatever. It is true, except what if you're trying to take over a certain industry? Like, somebody is going to end up being the loser of that. So violence is too strong a word, mm-hmm. but there is kind of a mercilessness to capitalism that I suppose all practitioners inevitably have to absorb to some degree.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Well, first of all, I'm slowly making my way through The Splendid and the Vile. The
great, yes.
It's great. I'm a big fan of now reading more about Churchill. But I it's funny that you mention, you know, the violence of capitalism, because I feel like we're at this really interesting stage with Amazon. It has now kind of become the company that basically the mainstream media, the tech press loves to scrutinize, a lot of criticism. The pendulum has swung, at least in the press, I think, towards more negativity around Amazon. And I think, you know, and part of it fairly and maybe part of it unfairly, the kind of is the world is sort of demanding that Amazon be nicer. And yet they've always, you know, been fighting, right? They've always viewed like their mission in life to, you know, to grow, to expand, to gain market share, to satisfy customers, whatever the cost. And so we're seeing this collision now in this kind of Amazon's existential reason for being, and it's the corporate values that Bezos set up early on, and now society's demands that this company operate a little bit differently.
Yeah, what was that early project they had? It was like Project Gazelle or something, like that. Right. They wanted to feast on publishers, like a lion on a gazelle or something. There, that sort of does seem to encapsulate
cheetah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was funny because that came up again in one of that was an anecdote again from the Everything Store. And that anecdote came up in the testimony in the House Antitrust Subcommittee, and Bezos was asked about it. This was last year when he was testifying virtually.
Yeah.
And of course, he said he didn't recall it. But and that goes back to the mid-2000s when Amazon is struggling basically to survive, you know, to get its house in order so that it could begin investing and expanding again into other market categories. And Bezos orders a set of renegotiations with the book publishers to more accurately reflect the value Amazon was bringing to them. And he brought a kind of ruthlessness to it.
Yeah. As an author, I imagine you are of two minds. And it's every time I hear authors, I actually also own a small indie bookstore as well. So I've sort of seen it from all sides. But, you know, you hear from people in publishing that really sort of hate Amazon. And sort of see it as this, you know, evil behemoth or whatever. And then I try to remember, it's like Amazon paid for my house, mm-hmm. you know? Amazon is responsible, I think, for what, like 80 or 90% of all book sales at this point when you take Kindle and audio, but then also most people buy online. It's, I don't always get the hatred of it because I have experienced all sides of it. I'm not sure if as many people would have purchased my books if Amazon hadn't right. made purchasing them both as easy as it is and also as affordable as it is. So that's a good thing.
No doubt. And you think you're in a weird situation vis-a-vis Amazon. I mean, I'm selling books about Amazon.
On Amazon.
On Amazon. And by the way, indie bookstores do not, at least anecdotally, I can report that they don't seem to be great fans. Now, neither of these books have been embraced by Amazon. And if you remember, Bezos didn't like the Everything Store.
Didn't his wife review it?
Yeah, his wife gave me a 1-star review. But I mean, it's all you know, there are a million little heartbreaks to book publishing. Mm-hmm. And one is, you know, walking proudly into a bookstore and not seeing your book anywhere or buried, you know, in the back. And I just think, yeah, it's awkward, right? Because even though these are, I'm trying to write nuanced histories with the good and the bad. My sales are by and large on Amazon.
Yeah, it's also weird too. I think it's very easy to talk about sort of kind, clever. It's also easy to be sort of glib about things. And not actually have any real basis in reality. Like, people are like, I'm boycotting Amazon. I only buy from indie retailers or something, mm-hmm. which, of course, as the owner of an indie bookstore, I certainly appreciate. But one of the things that, you know, you learn when you get under the hood is like, well, where are the indie bookstores getting their books? Well, they're getting them from a distributor,
right,
who in turn is a multi-billion dollar distributor named Ingram, mm-hmm. who in turn is getting them from publishers who are, you know, multi-billion dollar companies. You can have this idea of like, oh, I'm buying from the little guy, but there really is no escaping mm-hmm. the fact that there are several middlemen between you and the person who created the art or the product that you're buying. And it's kind of like pick your poison. The idea that you can somehow be above it all is probably naive at best, you know, totally untrue and impossible at worst.
Right. In this new book, I was very interested. You know, I don't write a lot about the book publishing industry and Amazon Unbound, but I was very interested in the way in which Amazon views its original business and how it sort of moved beyond it. Mm-hmm. I was giving a virtual presentation to the Association of American Publishers, and I said, "You guys are like the children from a previous marriage. Like they, you know, they're fond of you, but you know, but the attention's really on all the new kids right now, and that's Alexa and Hollywood and their transportation division. So it's funny, the book publishing industry still somewhat obsesses about Amazon, and I really do get the feeling that Amazon's kind of moved on."
Oh, I think that's totally right. Yeah, I have sort of two experiences there. I did the marketing on a book by Tim Ferriss a few years ago that was published by Amazon. And I remember we went into it thinking, well, what's it going to be like having, you know, the biggest bookstore in the world also publishing your book? Obviously, Amazon is just going to turn the fire hose on this book. And then you realize like, oh, Amazon makes more money selling refrigerators than like the entire book publishing industry. This is such a low priority for them that it's almost insignificant to them. It's probably in some cases like more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah, it was a staging ground it was Normandy Beach. but there, I have one anecdote in Amazon Unbound where Bezos is running through headcount and he's worried that the company is getting too big or too fat and that operating margins have decreased. And he comes upon a proposal for the book division, and he says, like, why do we need any more people here? You know, we already dominate it.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Yeah, it's strange. And there is this jockeying, right? And I think I found there was an issue with a few of my books a couple years ago where somebody in like India or something was selling pirated copies of the books. Mm-hmm. And it's Amazon's copyright issue, which is more than just publishing. It's all throughout Amazon is, you know, third party sellers selling counterfeit or copyright infringing goods. And so somehow, like, basically corrupted, pirated stock, it sort of gets into the thing. It has the buy button. It's this whole thing. And it costs, you know, many, many thousands of copies in sales. And I remember, mm-hmm. you know, talking to the publisher, I was like, you know, who's going to make me whole on this? Like, who's going to fix this? And I remember them saying, you know, we're talking to Amazon, but Amazon doesn't care. And I was like, that's cool, but I'm talking to you. And they were like, well, what do you mean? And I was like, that's your problem. I was like, you know, I sold my book to a multi-billion dollar company, so they would handle things like this. And they said something like, you know, well, Amazon doesn't care about the little guy. And I remember thinking, like, fuck you, you're not the little guy. You did like $30 billion in sales last year. But so I think it's interesting when we have these debates about, is Amazon too big? Is Amazon, you know, using its market power unfairly? It's not like, it's not squeezing in necessarily on small mom and pop businesses. The people it's squeezing are the other large businesses, right. And those companies are then, you know, crying foul as if they don't do the exact same thing to the people smaller. That's how the food chain works, is I guess what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, but I think an element of the frustration from the publisher there is that Amazon can be such an absent partner. So your publisher probably wanted to move quickly to get Amazon to boot out that overseas counterfeiter. But they're just not responsive. They've set up automated systems, and they can be very difficult to deal with. People probably are going to get tired if we just keep complaining about. but like, one funny thing, when Amazon Unbound was published, how many of these sort of algorithmically generated little paperbacks or Kindle books came out, like summary and analysis of Amazon Unbound or guide to Amazon Unbound. And I bought a couple of them, and they're just nonsense. They're like literally translations of translations of translations back into English. And like nobody, so my point is nobody is minding the store.
It's
literally, they have set it up as a self-service thing, and they've got 90% of the book business. And I'm sympathetic to book publishers who are complete, even though they are large corporations, they're at the mercy of this juggernaut who really does not, you know, seem to, you know, to care as much as it once did.
Well, I think that's a microcosm to take this out of publishing, of where the world is going and the good and bad of it, which is like, yeah, when your publisher is trying to get Barnes & Noble to support a book, they call a person and they can, there's that old school sort of pressing of the flesh, like, you know, we really sold them, they're excited, they liked our presentation, and here's what we're going to do, you know, in the way that, you know, a DJ might have gotten excited about a song in the 1950s or 60s and that made the artist. And when it comes to Amazon, the reps at the publisher are talking to an algorithm in the same way that, you know, YouTube isn't picking what it thinks is going to be hot. It's an algorithm, and that algorithm can also incidentally, you know, create radicalization or polarization that we've sort of, that maybe in the mid 20th century, it was about outsourcing overseas. Now it's about outsourcing to an algorithm.
Yes.
And then how do you hold an algorithm accountable for the the effects or consequences of its decisions. That's really difficult.
Right. And the mistakes. I mean, a lot of the recent journalism around Amazon has been the quality of work and life in the fulfillment centers and in the transportation division. And there are workers and drivers who they have a bad day and the algorithms take note and they're put on performance improvement plans or they're fired and they have no recourse. And this is what Amazon has done across its business. They start new divisions with careful, personalized attention from employees, sometimes from Bezos himself, and then they graduate into these scale businesses and they're run by technology.
Yeah, and that's kind of terrifying because an algorithm doesn't care about the people on the other side of the equation. I think that again sort of encapsulates where we are as a society, which is that, you know, we've reduced people and complicated things like culture down to, you know, how it can be translated into data.
Yeah, exactly right. And the human cost is kind of appalling. I mean, it's all anecdotal, right? I mean, the majority of workers and of drivers probably have fine experiences. But, you know, what we're finding now, what we've been finding for a few years among, you know, those of us who cover the big tech companies and cover Amazon is that the anecdotes are very powerful. You know, people who depend on Amazon to make money for their families or during the pandemic who are depending on it, and, you know, they have a bad day. Or even you know, there are powerful examples where, you know, it's almost mysterious why the algorithm picks them out, and you know, and then suddenly they've lost their job after working diligently for years. So yeah, I really feel like Amazon's recognized this, and this is why Bezos in his last shareholder letter, you know, talked about wanting to be a more empathetic company.
Is this, because I know you've written about other tech companies as well, like when you look at like the Gilded Age or the robber barons of the past, there was this, like they were sort of making these transformative decisions, these huge innovations, but there was kind of a complete indifference to like the actual workers at the steel mill or the people down in the mines or, you know, the people in the sewing factory or whatever it was. And only later, you know, like in the case of an Andrew Carnegie, does the sort of, or John D. Rockefeller, does the sort of philanthropic, you know, impulse kick in, the desire to then, it's sort of, they made this money in a somewhat exploitative or somewhat, let's call it, indifferent way to the human cost. Then later it's like, okay, how do I make good for society? So the environmental costs and the human costs of that, is that kind of where we are now with these giant companies making big decisions algorithmically that affect the lives of all these people and kind of just now waking up to like, oh, hey, you know, this decision to do the Facebook news feed this way mm-hmm. now determines how a presidential election comes out. And are these founders, do you think they're starting to wrestle with that, or are they still like detached from it or deliberately mm-hmm. hiding from it?
Well, no, I think it's going to be easiest for me to talk about Amazon here.
Sure.
I think they are wrestling with it. And it's funny, I'm going to talk about this, and sometimes I have to make sure that I'm not like sort of being apologetic for Amazon. I feel like in the early years, a couple of things were happening. One, I think there was an awareness that like the warehouse work wasn't great. And, you know, you probably wanted to move people through it fairly quickly and move them on to other opportunities. And so like when Bezos develops a tuition reimbursement program, you know, he's very focused on basically this education program being just for high growth fields like computer science, right? He's not going to pay somebody's tuition to go take poetry classes. And I've got a funny anecdote about that. The other thing was he was very cognizant, and they fought me on this, but you know, I believe he was very cognizant of the risk of unions and the threat of having an entrenched workforce that became more susceptible to organized labor. And then you'd have a situation where Amazon would lose the flexibility and start to resemble more like the giant automakers or the airlines. And so both of those things created this sort of high velocity, high turnover, very transactional workforce in the fulfillment centers where literally – you know, unless you were promoted after 3 years, you really weren't working at Amazon anymore. And in fact, and I have this in the book, Bezos said, after 3 years, you're not going to get any more raises. And that, it sounds heartless. It really does. And, you know, but I feel like, the unions were one thing. And also he just didn't want people getting complacent and not giving Amazon their best. And now to finally answer your question, Ryan, I do think they're wrestling with that. First of all, because of the sheer numbers. I mean, they employ 1 million people in their warehouses in a time of very low unemployment. And, you know, Amazon's wrestling with how are they going to hire the next batch of people to get through the holiday season. But also it's just the criticism, the avalanche of criticism from the fulfillment centers about how much of a sort of distant and cruel master Amazon can be. So I think they're having to finally kind of tinker with some of those levers.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. So, it, you know, to an outsider, you might look at these warehouses and you go, this is kind of a dead-end job. You know, why isn't there this or that? And that perhaps that's actually more of a feature than a bug. The idea is like, this is supposed to be temporary work or you get promoted or this isn't the right place for you, but we don't want you to work at the warehouse for 20 years.
Right. I actually thought, so you remember did you see Nomadland?
Yes.
Yeah. And it, you know, it was a wonderful film and it got a lot of criticism. Well, it got some criticism for being actually too sympathetic to Amazon or at mm-hmm. least not portraying any, you know, angry bosses, you know, yelling at the Frances McDormand. But I actually thought it was like a perfect depiction because it kind of captured the melancholy transactional nature of the work, right? She shows up once a year. There's this like quiet camaraderie and then everyone goes their separate ways. And I don't know. I thought that was kind of right. You know, that this is a, you know, it's a way station for some workers and they come and they go and maybe they do a year, then they leave and then they go back to it. But no, it's the work certainly is not glamorous.
Yeah, we spent some time in RV parks like that. We bought a camper at the beginning of the pandemic and we've gone around. And it is an interesting slice of humanity and life that I think your average successful, particularly urban person has no understanding of. But you realize, oh, these people, they live here, but not really live here because they're here for 3 months working on an oil rig or they're 3 months at this Amazon warehouse temporarily, and then they're moving on to do construction at the new Tesla factory. They're just kind of going around from these things to thing. And it was actually helpful for me trying to understand, okay, like, who are these people, you know, believing conspiracy? I'm painting with a very broad mm-hmm. brush here, but when you think about people who are, you know, falling for a conspiracy theory or, mm-hmm. or voting for this candidate or that candidate, like, you're like, who are these people? I don't know any of them. It's like, I would urge you to go spend a week in a, you know, in an RV park in Arizona or any of the states. And you'd be like, oh, okay, this is a large part of American society. These are hardworking people. These are people who'd help you with a flat tire by the side of the road, but their existence is vastly different
right.
than what yours is like. And their media diet as a result is very different. And so much of their experience is day to day is just transformatively different than yours. I think Nomadland did a good job providing a window into that world.
Yeah. And I am personally always sort of careful, like, does my critique of Amazon culture, the work in the warehouses, or does the mainstream, you know, the other tech press's critique, does it represent a kind of coastal elitist sheltered view? And yeah. I think it's true. Like, Amazon is now the second largest employer in the country. It will probably soon be the first, eclipsing Walmart. And there's something to the fact that, you know, they're bringing economic opportunity to the parts of the country where otherwise it probably wouldn't exist.
Did you see that SNL skit last year that was like, what still works, or, you know, does it still work? And it was like going through the different parts of American culture and it's like, turns out nothing works. Right. And one thing they settled on that was still working was Tom Brady, that like Tom Brady's as good as he was 20 years ago, if not better. But I'd argue, like, Amazon, like, when I think of the last, you know, year and a half, and I'm like, what American institutions did not massively let us down when things were really mm-hmm. bad. I kind of think the U.S. military has done a pretty damn good job, and Amazon performed perhaps even better than expectations.
Yeah. And that's the last chapter in my book. And you'll appreciate, Ryan, I started working on this book in 2017. So I knew there was a whole kind of new chapter to the Amazon story, but I didn't really know where it would take me. And as I was working on the book, I had HQ2, Bezos's fight with the National Enquirer, the antitrust scrutiny started by David Cicilline and Lina Khan in the House, and then the pandemic, which was the last chapter. And, you know, they weren't perfect. They, in the way in which they fired whistleblowers and, you know, commented upon some of the activist workers in the warehouses was troubling. I think during the period of ambiguity early in the pandemic, March of 2020, they, like a lot of other companies, made mistakes and put employees at risk. And some of those HR systems didn't scale as well as they should have. But by and large, yeah, Amazon was a lifeline. And I try to say this as much as I can. You know, we're Prime members, we're Alexa owners, and we did rely on Amazon and Whole Foods and Amazon Fresh Delivery during the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, what else would you have relied on? That they were, in some cases, the only, you know, avenue available.
Right. And but it's so funny because I think a lot of the current enmity is around how they navigated the pandemic and how profitable and productive it was for them. And there is a sort of perversity to the fact that Amazon and all the big tech companies, you know, going into the pandemic had all of the advantages, and then even more so during, right? All of Amazon's physical retail competitors suddenly, you know, have to either close up shop or it becomes a health risk to go into those stores, and Amazon just booms. And, you know, it probably would have gotten where it is now without the pandemic, but it was an accelerant. Yeah. And I feel like Bezos kind of can't cut a break right now, in the popular press. And I think in large part it is because of the unseemliness of how well Amazon did during the pandemic.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Yeah, I feel like we're in a similar boat. I did a book a few years ago about Peter Thiel and his sort of quest to destroy Gawker, which I know he and mm-hmm. Bezos sort of disagreed on. But what I find, what I kept coming back to, and it sounds like it's a similar place you are, which is like, I don't agree with everything. In fact, some of it completely horrifies me. But on the other hand, I both respect and want to hold up the competence. Because competence and the ability to execute and do big things is severely and sorely lacking pretty much anywhere else in American life. So it's like, you know, you could go like, wouldn't it be better if Jeff Bezos was this, that, or the other? But you're just sort of like, compared to who? Like, who would you rather have, you know, operating the world's largest e-commerce business in the middle of the pandemic? Like, I'm not sure if you can trade off like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need the competence. Like, it's a good, it would be wonderful if the competence could be more empathetic and kind, but right. at the same time, better than incompetence.
Right. That is true. I mean, there is a critique though. And I hope it comes out in Amazon Unbound, which is, you know, developing these systems, moving fast, you know, having customer needs as kind of the North Star, and then constructing systems to minimize risk, to maximize operating leverage. A great example is the transportation network. And I tell this story in one of the chapters in the middle of the book where, you know, they realized they couldn't rely on FedEx or UPS or even the National Postal Service. They were basically outgrowing all of their logistics providers. But they knew if they started employing drivers, you know, that would create an opening for the Teamsters. And so they set up, basically create this kind of fissured workplace arrangement where they hire independent companies who will hire the drivers. And they manage all those companies, of course, with algorithms, as we were talking about. And the drivers drive Amazon vans and they wear Amazon uniforms, but they're not Amazon employees. And, you know, in the early days, and BuzzFeed, and I think it was ProPublica, did great journalism about this. You know, in the early days, those drivers were set upon the world with these ferocious deadlines and massive, you know, obligations to deliver packages for the company. And there was some real carnage on the road, right, in terms of accidents and pedestrian deaths and whatnot. And then a torrent of lawsuits, of course, that are still being wrangled in the courts and some very quiet settlements. And so, yeah, Amazon, they build with competence and confidence, and it's amazing to behold, but there have been costs along the way.
So what is that? I'm fascinated with it because on the one hand, you sort of objectively understand like, okay, it's cheaper to do it this way, less liability to do it this way. At the same time, of all the companies that could afford to do it the right way, like why doesn't Walmart just pay a dollar more an hour? Why doesn't Amazon right. just say we're going to hire the, like what, when you have so much money and so much power, what is it? Just the culture of optimization makes it inconceivable to think about doing it any way other than the most efficient way, like, or because it's legal, therefore it's allowed.
Right. And look, they didn't invent this particular wheel. You know, FedEx has probably been the leader in contracting with drivers. And FedEx went through years and years of litigation and ultimately Supreme Court rulings saying that it was allowed. And DHL does the same thing. Now UPS employs its drivers. So the fissured, and this is, I'm borrowing this term from this Brandeis University professor who wrote this great book, The Fissured Workplace. But the contract relationship, yeah, it's being used all across the economy, from the janitors at Apple to the cafeteria workers at Google. And it's right; it's more efficient, and you know, you avoid potential union incursions, and you kind of offload all the messiness onto independent contractors, and Amazon needed to get going really quickly and to grow because it was outgrowing its logistics partners. So, you know, that was probably the right thing for them to do at the time. But there were costs.
And the danger is, if you're not perfectly optimized, if you decide, hey, we're going to do the right thing, even though it, you know, is 30% less efficient, the danger is what? A competitor comes in, or a hedge fund buys up shares and pressures you to come around and do the other. Like, I guess it's like when you're the world's richest man, when you have so much market dominance, why not do it the right way?
Like, right.
I wonder if you had any insight.
Right. I think in the book I wrote that it was fear of unions. Now they might disagree with that, but look, the Teamsters just announced at their annual meeting that they're creating a completely new division to focus exclusively on Amazon. And it will be difficult for the Teamsters because Amazon doesn't have any drivers. They don't work for Amazon.
Yeah.
So I believe that was one of the main things. But, you know, when you talk about, but I mean, I think what would need to happen is the law would need to change, because, you know, the fact that right now those drivers wear Amazon uniforms and drive Amazon vans, and increasingly there are cameras and other technologies in the cars that monitor their performance. You remember the little dust up about how Amazon was putting cameras in these vehicles?
Yeah.
So right now it's quacking and walking and talking like a duck, right?
Right.
They really look like Amazon employees. So I do think the law would need to change for companies like FedEx and Amazon and DHL to start employing their drivers.
It is interesting to me, you know, people will spend a lot of time, you know, looking at the practices of a company like Amazon and decide, you know, you don't like this, that, or the other. And then I think your point is interesting. It's like, sure, but do you have a cleaning crew instead of hiring, you know, a full-time custodian at your office? Like it's interesting, as you point out, that these are somewhat standard practices for businesses, big and small, maybe even, you know, a medium-sized, you know, the owner of a medium-sized company that's listening right now might do some of these things. It's really just when you see the awesome scale of it at Amazon, that the sort of moral repugnance or moral, you know, tension of it becomes harder to bear. It's same with, like, when you read about, you know, Jeff Bezos not paying taxes. It's like,
right,
you're probably personally trying, not you, I just, everyone mm-hmm. is personally trying to reduce their tax burden. And then it's only when you see someone worth billions of dollars do it that you cry foul.
Right. Yes. I could not believe that. Like, dude, did you really take the child tax credit? But of course, I mean, he might not have even, it's probably like his tax folks that are right doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does, in both of these cases, it really starts with the law, right? And why aren't we means testing some of these things? And for larger companies, why isn't there an obligation for them to treat their employees fairly or to even, you know, quote unquote, employ them? If they're if they're spending their entire careers working for the company.
Well, I see it all the time where people go, you know, I hate these companies. They're outsourcing. They're doing this. They're doing that. And then it's like, then they're like, hey, I have this great idea for a t-shirt. And you're like, oh, mm-hmm. cool. And you're like, and then you're like, so which one are you going to buy? And they're like, well, obviously we're going to buy it from the one in China. It's cheaper. You know, like
right,
the
right.
second we have the ability to, I think this is actually what's interesting about Shopify. And I had Tobias, the founder of Shopify, on a couple months ago. What some of the sort of the e-commerce revolution is doing is weirdly bringing some of these previously, you know, decisions that were previously only in the reach of, you know, true industrialists down home to you. You're deciding, hey, I had this idea for this little product. And now suddenly you're having to decide whether you want to spend 40% more to manufacture it domestically, or are you going to get the best price by getting it made in Bangladesh? You know, like suddenly it's not so easy to be glib about it when
right.
it's your profit margins that it's eating into.
Yeah. Nope. That's exactly right.
So one of the things I'm fascinated with someone like Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk or whomever is, you know, is there ever enough for these people? Like, I guess it's like, you know, I get you found a company, become successful, you ride it. I'm always fascinated with the need to do another thing and another thing and another thing all at the same time. And then suddenly they're also, Jeff Bezos is personally involved in the Hollywood projects they're green lighting, and suddenly he's also running the Washington Post. Like, is there like just an eternal restlessness in these people, mm-hmm. or what is it that makes them continue going when they have more than a human being could ever possibly need?
It's an interesting question. Well, I mean, look at it from Bezos's point of view. He is, there are still risks all around Amazon. They're major competitors that seem very formidable. He's dealing with Google and Apple, Google in the consumer business, trying to get into shopping, Apple with devices, Microsoft and Google in the cloud business. I'm sure it doesn't feel like smooth sailing. And at the same time, you mentioned Hollywood. They've got a 15 years ago, a good business selling DVDs, and suddenly that goes away. So if they do nothing, then Amazon is going to shrink. And so they develop a video on demand store. And then Netflix starts to undermine video on demand, buying TV shows and movies online. And so if they do nothing, Amazon will shrink. So then the answer is, okay, they're going to have to do a subscription service themselves. And they don't have as big of a library. So Bezos integrates that into Prime. And then suddenly Amazon's paying huge amounts of money to studios and networks to license programming. So if they do nothing, Amazon's numbers are going to start to decline because it's so expensive to license content. And so they create Amazon Studios and they start to make their own programming, and then Disney and Apple and Paramount and all the other big studios start to open streaming services themselves. And so if Amazon does nothing, they're going to be outclassed. So they buy MGM, right? And so this is just an example of how, yes, it seems like he has everything, but if he stops paddling the boat, the boat slows down, right? And so he's always like eyes on the future, looking ahead to the next move. Although in some respects, Ryan, maybe he has stopped, right? Because he's no longer CEO. So now he's devoting himself to other things.
No, that's a really profound way of expressing that. I'm glad you did that. What he's for all of his success and power and freedom, he actually has no ability to do nothing, or both existentially and financially, you can't rest on your laurels because at the level that you're at, someone is always coming and trying to disrupt you, just in the way that you disrupted publishers and Barnes & Noble and Borders, two decades ago.
Right. Exactly. And one of the things that Bezos says often is, if you fight the future will win. You always need to be leaning up against the future, leaning into the future, inventing the next thing, riding the next wave. And I think it sounds trite, but it's sort of fundamental to his philosophy. What technology has created kind of the most rapid set of changes in the business world in generations. And unless you're constantly riding that wave, you're going to get left behind.
Yeah, that it's always day one thing on the one hand is kind of inspiring and cool. And you look at it from the outside as being, awesome. But it's probably also exhausting that 20, 25 years in, you're making trillions of dollars and you don't actually ever get to relax or just be.
Right. No, I think this is like part of the critique of the culture, why it is so relentless. It's this notion Bezos seeded into the company very early on that unless they're rushing ahead, arms outstretched at all times, are going to get left behind. And that is, I think, exhausting is a good word for it.
I've said that before where like evolutionarily it's good, like Elon Musk starts a company and that's not enough. So he has to start another company. I understand why evolutionarily that's good. From a capitalistic perspective, I understand why that's good. But then when I look at it, I wonder if it's actually fun to be Elon Musk. So it's like good collectively, but perhaps tragic or costly individually.
And we shouldn't discount the element of ego in all this, right? Okay. I mean, I think that like with the space initiative, and I have a chapter about Blue Origin in this book, and Bezos was content to move very slowly, and he saw it, I think, as a sort of multi-generational effort. And then Elon, you know, with SpaceX kind of changes the game in space and starts to fund SpaceX with government contracts and commercial contracts, and he's going much faster, and he's eclipsing Bezos as the tech space entrepreneur. And now here, Bezos is about to go at least some personal risk to himself, I would imagine, on the very first crewed New Shepard launch on July 20th. And I do think there's and you can see them fight mildly on Twitter. I think there's a spirited competition there. And some of the restlessness that we're talking about is a little bit of these guys feeling, you know, wanting to be the last man standing.
Yeah, in the same way that you and I might look at another author who published at the same time and go, you know, how did they get that? Or, you know, why is their book selling more than mine? I'm always surprised when you meet some of these people that they actually do notice that someone is three names above them on the Forbes list, or that someone else got this profile, or, you know, is someone else is getting a pass where or is seen as this. Like, I think Elon Musk is the sort of rock star CEO, makes a lot of other CEOs who previously were content to be boring or not have large public platforms suddenly go, well, if he has it, I have to have that too.
I like how you just declared the billionaire ego contest to the sad psychology of the author who's obsessing over the sales list and complaining to their significant other. Why am I not higher up on the sales? Why is my Amazon ranking falling?
Yes. Well, I've noticed I've met, you know, my handful of these people that we're sort of talking about, and they all want to do books because so-and-so did a book and it was popular. And, you know, it's like, you know, Ray Dalio does a book and it's a huge hit. So now all the other hedge fund people need to do a book about, you know, their investment philosophy. And, you know, it's clearly not about the money that they can make from the project. It's about some other kind, like the ability for humans to create rankings and then want to compete in those rankings is like the primary driving force of our species, I guess.
Yes, and the secret to the success of and the longevity of U.S. News and World Report, apparently.
Of course. No, that's the college admissions scandal. You're right. It's just right. Like, I don't want my daughter to go to ASU, not when the other guy at the office, you know, sent his daughter to University of Texas. Mm-hmm. And do you think it's enjoyable to be Jeff Bezos, or is it a tortured existence?
No, I'm going to quick non sequitur. Did you see Mark Zuckerberg post over the weekend?
Yes.
His hoverboard or what is that thing with the American flag?
A foil. I forget what it's called, right. But yes, it's some sort of weird surfboard.
Right. And he's holding the American flag and like instantly, you know, you can hear the collective disapproval of his Twitter critics and 1,000 memes being born. And he just doesn't care. Right?
Right.
Why would he? He's having a ball. He's Mark Zuckerberg. He's a billionaire. Facebook's a $1 trillion company. The success is unrivaled. I think that's the same with Bezos. He doesn't care.
But don't you think, he did post that. Why would he have posted it if he didn't need the same social media validation? I bet he looked at the views and he's happy with how many views it's done.
Well, and similarly, like Bezos is posting to Instagram now quite a bit about space. This weekend I saw he's off on Barry Diller's yacht. You know, he's building an identical yacht, which I wrote about in the book. They're gallivanting around the Mediterranean. You know, they know that the tabloid, you know, photographers will report about this, that being the richest guy in the world and being on a luxury yacht in the middle of the Mediterranean, it's not a great look.
Yeah.
But he doesn't care. No, he doesn't. I don't think he cares at all. I think that he's hovering at a much higher altitude.
Yeah.
Where who knows how much of this he sees. But by and large, I think he's extremely confident and deservedly so of his success, and probably feels like, he's got these long-term things that'll, maybe, you know, that ultimately, like, the world will come around. No, I'm not to say that he doesn't care about his image, because he obviously does. He wouldn't be curating the Instagram feed so heavily if he didn't care. But I don't. I think that, look, if you asked whether the existence was a pleasurable one, I mean, clearly he's enjoying himself right now.
Yeah, it's every once in a while you'll be at a conference, obviously not in a while, but you'll be at a conference and, you know, some person like a Jeff Bezos will be there with the same badge sitting around, and you're just like, I know why I'm here. What compels you to be here? So right. I sometimes I wonder if they're on a treadmill that they can't get off, or do they actually enjoy it and they're just doing what anyone would do if they could do whatever they wanted. I can't always tell.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's still, like, one word that he uses a lot is adventure. And he used it in the Instagram post where he was inviting his brother to come on the rocket ship with him. When he toasts, some friends of his and workers of his have told me he'll toast to adventure and fellowship. The things that he's done over the past 10 years, taking expedition out into the Atlantic Ocean to find I think it was the Apollo era rockets on the seabed floor, or going to the North Pole and dog sledding. You know, he's all about pursuing adventures and unique experiences. And it's almost like the same kind of restlessness that he brought to Amazon, always moving forward, always doing something new, you know, he's brought to his personal life. So I don't know that I would describe it as a compulsion. I think it's like, you know, he's living life to the fullest.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. What do you think? You're in the somewhat unusual position of being able to write a book about a topic, and then, like, enough stuff happened, you're writing a second book about the topic. Obviously, lots happened in between. But I'm curious, as you sat down to write about the book, I imagine you were thinking, you know, you don't have to have read the first book to read the second one. As you got a second crack at some of the stuff, what do you think you got wrong the first time?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know if I feel like I got anything wrong. I mean, you know, Amazon,
well, like your read on a certain thing is different than,
right,
you know, like in the two Michael Lewis's new book, he basically sort of admits that in the fifth risk, he got the CDC wrong, that he, that they weren't what he thought they were.
Yeah. Okay. So in the Everything Store, we talked a little bit about this. I have a lot of fun kind of chronicling Bezos's one line devastating remarks to employees where he kind of cut them off at the knees. And I even have a sort of list of them. I'm scanning the book to see if I can find it. I probably can't, but I kind of like have an all time greatest hits. Mm-hmm. And I think that gave the impression of a kind of Jobsian monster who spoke impulsively and emotionally. And as I said, I think it was true for a while, but he's sort of much more methodical about that. And I don't think I did a good enough job in the first book showing the evolution of the management style. And that's, I think, hopefully comes through a little bit more in Amazon Unbound, that he isn't a Steve Jobs-like figure. You know, he's much more methodical and deliberate. You know, he'll often speak last at a meeting. You know, he'll go one by one and question everyone in the room. You know, he's very careful about how he, you know, how he weighs in, because he knows that as the founder, as the CEO, as this legendary business figure, you know, his words carry a lot of weight, and they can spark a whole, a month of wheel spinning and paper writing inside the company if he says something flippantly. So I think probably if folks read the Everything Store, they were titillated a little bit by the depiction of Bezos as a kind of, you know, office monster. And that's, you know, and hopefully there was, it's really part of a more nuanced portrayal. But as we all know, people gravitate towards the most sensational stuff. So that's the one thing that I would say.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes in Silicon Valley. The CEO of Hulu or something says, like, the bear is sticky with honey. He's like trying to get tea, and you know, the little honey bear. He says this, and all the employees take it to mean some like grand philosophical remark, and it sends them on this crazy cycle. All right, I know you got to go, but one last question. I was curious. You described the sort of the scandal, the divorce, whatever scandal, Jeff Bezos' mistress or what have you. You describe it as a shocking lapse in discipline. I'm working on a book right now about discipline, and he does seem that for a person who can do and say anything he wants, he has remained remarkably self-contained and disciplined. I'm just curious on your read on this idea of temperance. Despite all his fame and fortune, he does seem to be relatively self-contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, other than the Lauren Sanchez National Enquirer scandal, which is still mystifying to me, why he conducted himself in that relationship basically out in the open at restaurants in LA, at hotels, restaurants in Miami and New York, out in the open, and somehow assumed that the tabloid media wouldn't be interested in the private affairs of one of the richest people in the world. And then they were, and then he, you know, ascribed political motives to it and blamed the government of Saudi Arabia when, you know, all the available evidence suggests that it was Lauren Sanchez's brother who turned over that information. That I think remains a sort of aberration in the Bezos story. And now when you see, you know, first of all, he appears publicly, excuse me, Ryan, he appears publicly so seldomly. And when he speaks on social media, it's very curated. So yeah, I think he operates right now with a lot of discipline, particularly when it comes to his public image.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how many of us would be able to maintain that if suddenly we were thrust in a truly limitless, powerful position. I always wonder what you would do if you suddenly had everything and could do anything.
I don't know that I would be strapping myself to the top of a rocket to go to space, but True. Otherwise I probably would be enjoying myself.
I think so. Brad, thank you so much. I loved the books and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you, Ryan. Great talking to you.
Hey, it's Ryan. If you want to take your study of Stoicism to the next level, I want to invite you to join us over at Daily Stoic Life. We have daily conversations about the podcast episodes, about the daily email. We actually do a special weekend set of emails for everyone. You get all our Daily Stoic courses and challenges totally for free. That's hundreds of dollars of value every single year, including our New Year, New You Challenge, which we're going to launch in January. You get a special cloth-bound edition of the best of meditations that we've done. You get a bunch of cool stuff. It's an awesome community. I've loved being a part of it. I've loved getting to meet everyone who's trying to take their study of Stoicism to the next level. Love to have you join us. Check us out at dailystoiclife.com. We'd love to have you and join us on this digital Stoa that we've staked out together and get better every day. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible
interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He asks real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.